turned it to inspect the edge, while the pommel and crossguard flamed gold.
With this fool's jabber of Stannis and his magic sword, it seemed to me that we had best give Joffrey something extraordinary as well. A king should bear a kingly weapon.
That's much too much sword for Joff, Tyrion said.
He will grow into it. Here, feel the weight of it.
He offered the weapon hilt first. The sword was much lighter than he had expected. As he turned it in his hand, he saw why. Only one metal could be beaten so thin and still have strength enough to fight with, and there was no mistaking those ripples, the mark of steel that has been folded back on itself many thousands of times. Valyrian steel?
Yes,
Lord Tywin said, in a tone of deep satisfaction. At long last, father. Valyrian steel blades were scarce and costly, yet thousands remained in the world, perhaps 200 in the Seven Kingdoms alone. It had always irked his father that none belonged to House Lannister. The old kings of the Rock had owned such a weapon, but the great sword Brightroar had been lost when the second king Tommen carried it back to Valyria on his fool's quest. He had never returned, nor had Uncle Gerry, the youngest and most reckless of his father's brothers, who had gone seeking after the lost sword some 8 years past. Thrice at least Lord Tywin had offered to buy Valyrian longswords from impoverished lesser houses, but his advances had always been firmly rebuffed. The little lordlings would gladly part with their daughters, should a Lannister come asking, but they cherished their old family swords. Tyrion wondered where the metal for this one had come from. A few master armourers could rework old Valyrian steel, but the secrets of its making had been lost when the doom came to old Valyria. "The colours are strange," he commented as he turned the blade in the sunlight. Most Valyrian steel was a grey so dark it looked almost black, as was true here as well. But blended into the folds was a red, as deep as the grey. The two colours lapped over one another without ever touching, each ripple distinct, like waves of night and blood upon some steely shore.
"How did you get this patterning? I've never seen anything like it."
"Nor I, my lord," said the armourer. "I confess these colours were not what I intended, and I do not know that I could duplicate them. Your lord father had asked for the crimson of your house, and it was that colour I set out to infuse into the metal. But Valyrian steel is stubborn, eh? These old swords remember, it is said, and they do not change easily. I worked 50 spells and brightened the red time and time again, but always the colour would darken as if the blade was drinking the sun from it. And some foals would not take the red at all, as you can see. If my lords of Lannister are displeased, I will, of course, try again as many times as you should require, but—"
"No need," Lord Tywin said. "This will serve."
"A crimson sword might flash prettily in the sun, but if truth be told, I like these colours better," said Tyrion. "They have an ominous beauty, and they make this blade unique. There is no other sword like it in all the world, I should think."
"There is one."
The armourer bent over the table and unfolded the bundle of oilcloth to reveal a second longsword. Tyrion put down Joffrey's sword and took up the other. If not twins, the two were at least close cousins. This one was thicker and heavier, 1/2 inch wider and 3 inches longer, but they shared the same fine clean lines and the same distinctive colour, the ripples of blood and night. Three fullers, deeply incised, ran down the second blade from hilt to point. The king's sword had only two. Joff's hilt was a good deal more ornate, the arms of its crossguard done with lion's paws, with ruby claws unsheathed, but both swords had grips of finely tooled red leather and gold lion's heads for pummels.
Magnificent!
Even in hands as unskilled as Tyrion's, the blade felt alive.
"I have never felt better balance.
It is meant for my son.
No need to ask which son. Tyrion placed Jaime's sword back on the table beside Joffrey's, wondering if Robb Stark would let his brother live long enough to wield it. Our father must surely think so, else why have this blade forged?
You have done good work, Master Mutt, Lord Tywin told the armourer. My steward will see to your payment, and remember, rubies for the scabbards.
I shall, my lord, you are most generous.
The man folded the swords up in the oilcloth, tucked the bundle under one arm, and went to his knee.
It is an honour to serve the king's hand. I shall deliver the swords the day before the wedding.
I see that you do.
When the guards had seen the armour out, Tyrion clambered up into a chair. So, a sword for Joff, a sword for Jaime, and not even a dagger for the dwarf. Is that the way of it, father?
The steel was sufficient for two blades, not three. If you have need of a dagger, take one from the armory. Robert left 100 when he died. Geryon gave him a gilded dagger with an ivory grip and a sapphire pommel for a wedding gift. And half the envoys who came to court tried to curry favor by presenting his grace with jewel-encrusted knives and silver inlay swords.
Tyrion smiled. They'd have pleased him more if they'd presented him with their daughters.
No doubt. The only blade he ever used was a hunting knife he had from John Aaron when he was a boy.
Lord Tywin waved a hand, dismissing King Robert and all his knives.
What did you find at the riverfront?
Mud, said Tyrion, and a few dead things no one bothered to bury. Before we can open the port again, the Blackwater is going to have to be dredged, the sunken ships broken up or raised. 3/4 of the quays need repair, and some may have to be torn down and rebuilt. The entire fish market is gone, and both the River Gate and the King's Gate are splintered from the battering Stannis gave them and should be replaced. I shudder to think of the cost. If you do shit gold, father, find a privy and get busy.
He wanted to say, but he knew better.
You will find whatever gold is required.
Will I? Where? The treasury is empty. I've told you that. We've not done paying the alchemist for that wildfire, or the smiths for my chain. And Cersei's pledged the crown to pay half the cost of Joffrey's wedding. 77 bloody courses, 1,000 guests, a pie full of doves, singers, jugglers.
Extravagance has its uses. We must demonstrate the power and wealth of Casterly Rock for all the realm to see.
Then perhaps Casterly Rock should pay.
Why? I have seen Littlefinger's accounts. Crown incomes are 10 times higher than they were under Aerys.
As are the crown's expenses. Robert was as generous with his coin as he was with his cock. Littlefinger borrowed heavily. From you, amongst others? Yes, the incomes are considerable, but they are barely sufficient to cover the usury on Littlefinger's loans. Will you forgive the throne's debt to House Lannister?
Don't be absurd.
Then perhaps 7 courses would suffice. 300 guests instead of 1,000. I understand that a marriage can be just as binding without a dancing bear.
The Tyrells would think us niggardly. I will have the wedding and the waterfront. If you cannot pay for them, say so. And I shall find a master of coin who can.
The disgrace of being dismissed after so short a time was not something Tyrion cared to suffer. I will find your money.
You will, his father promised. And while you are about it, see if you can find your wife's bed as well.
So the talk has reached even him. I have, thank you. It's that piece of furniture between the window and the hearth, with the velvet canopy and the mattress stuffed with goose down.
I am pleased you know of it. Now perhaps you ought to try and know the woman who shares it with you.
Woman? Child, you mean? Has a spider been whispering in your ear, or do I have my sweet sister to thank?
Considering the things that went on beneath Circe's blankets, you would think she'd have the decency to keep her nose out of his.
Tell me, why is it that all of Sansa's maids are women in Circe's service? I am sick of being spied upon in my own chambers.
If you mislike your wife's servants, dismiss them and hire ones more to your liking. That is your right. It is your wife's maidenhood that concerns me, not her maids. This delicacy puzzles me. You seem to have no difficulty bedding whores. Is this Stark girl made differently?
Why would you take so much bloody interest in where I put my cock?
Tyrion demanded.
Sansa is too young.
She is old enough to be Lady of Winterfell once her brother is dead. Claim her maidenhood, and you will be one step closer to claiming the North. Get her with child, and the prize is all but won. Do I need to remind you that a marriage that has not been consummated can be set aside?
By the High Septon or a Council of Faith? Our present High Septon is a trained seal who barks prettily on command. Moonboy is more like to annul my marriage than he is.
Perhaps I should have married Sansa Stark to Moonboy. He might have known what to do with her.
Tyrion's hands clenched on the arms of his chair. I have heard all I mean to hear on the subject of my wife's maidenhead. But so long as we are discussing marriage, why is it that I hear nothing of my sister's impending nuptials? As I recall,
Lord Tywin cut him off,
Mace Tyrell has refused my offer to marry Cersei to his heir, Willis.
Refused, our sweet Cersei. That put Tyrion in a much better mood.
When I first broached the match to him, Lord Tyrell seemed well enough disposed, his father said. A day later, all that was changed. The old woman's work. She hectors her son unmercifully. Varys claims she told him that your sister was too old and too used for this precious one-legged grandson of hers.
Cersei must have loved that, he laughed.
Lord Tywin gave him a chilly look.
She does not know, nor will she. It is better for all of us if the offer was never made. See that you remember that, Tyrion. The offer was never made.
What offer?
Tyrion rather suspected that Lord Tyrell might come to regret this rebuff.
Your sister will be wed. The question is, to whom? I have several thoughts.
Before he could get to them, there was a rap at the door, and a guardsman stuck in his head to announce Grand Maester Pycelle.
He may enter, said Lord Tywin.
Pycelle tottered in on a cane and stopped long enough to give Tyrion a look that would curdle milk. His once magnificent white beard, which someone had unaccountably shaved off, was growing back sparse and wispy, leaving him with unsightly pink wattles to dangle beneath his neck.
My Lord Hend, the old man said, bowing as deeply as he could without falling, there has been another bird from Castle Black. Mayhaps we could consult privily.
There's no need for that.
Lord Tywin waved Grand Maester Pycelle to a seat.
Tyrion may stay.
Oh, may I?
He rubbed his nose and waited. Pycelle cleared his throat, which involved a deal of coughing and hawking.
The letter is from the same Bowen Marsh who sent the last, the Castellan. He writes that Lord Mormont has sent word of wildlings moving south in vast numbers.
The lands beyond the wall cannot support vast numbers, said Lord Tywin firmly. This warning is not new.
This last is, my lord. Mormont sent a bird from the haunted forest to report that he was under attack. More ravens have returned since, but none with letters. This Bowen Marsh fears Lord Mormont slain, with all his strength.
Tyrion had rather liked old Jor Mormont, with his gruff manner and talking bird.
"Is this certain?" he asked.
"It is not," Pycelle admitted, "but none of Mormont's men have returned as yet. Marsh fears the wildlings have killed them, and that the wall itself may be attacked next."
He fumbled in his robe and found the paper.
"Here is his letter, my lord, a plea to all five kings. He wants men, as many men as we can send him."
"Five kings?" His father was annoyed. "There is one king in Westeros. Those fools in black might try and remember that if they wish his grace to heed them. When you reply, tell him that Renly is dead, and the others are traitors and pretenders."
"No doubt they will be glad to learn it. The wall is a world apart, and news oft reaches them late."
Pycelle bobbed his head up and down.
"What shall I tell Marsh concerning the men he begs for? Shall we convene the council?"
"There is no need. The Night's Watch is a pack of thieves, killers, and base-born churls. But it occurs to me that they could prove otherwise, given proper discipline. If Mormont is indeed dead, the Black Brothers must choose a new Lord Commander." Pycelle gave Tyrion a sly glance.
"An excellent thought, my lord. I know the very man, Janus Slint."
Tyrion liked that notion not at all. "The Black Brothers choose their own commander," he reminded them. "Lord Slint is new to the wall. I know. I sent him there. Why should they pick him over a dozen more senior men?"
"Because," his father said, in a tone that suggested Tyrion was quite the simpleton, "if they do not vote as they are told, their wall will melt before it sees another man."
"Yes, that would work." Tyrion hitched forward.
"Janus Slint is the wrong man, father. We do better with the commander of the Shadow Tower, or Eastwatch by the sea."
"The commander of the Shadow Tower is a Malister of Seaguard. Eastwatch is held by an Iron Man."
"Neither would serve his purposes," Lord Tywin's tone said, clear enough.
"Janus Slint is a butcher's son," Tyrion reminded his father forcefully. "You yourself told me."
"I recall what I told you. Castle Black is not Harren Hal, however. The Night's Watch is not the King's Council. There is a tool for every task, and a task for every tool."
Tyrion's anger flashed.
"Lord Janus is a hollow suit of armour who will sell himself to the highest bidder."
"I count that a point in his favour. Who is like to bid higher than us?"
He turned to Pycelle.
"Send a raven. Write that King Joffrey was deeply saddened to hear of Lord Commander Mormont's death, but regrets that he can spare no men just now, while so many rebels and usurpers remain in the field. Suggest that matters might be quite different once the throne is secure. Provided the king has full confidence in the leadership of the watch. In closing, ask March to pass along his grace's fondest regards to his faithful friend and servant, Lord Janus Slint."
"Yes, my lord,"
Pycelle bobbed his withered head once more.
"I shall write as the hand commands, with great pleasure."
"I should have trimmed his head, not his beard," Tyrion reflected. "And Slint should have gone for a swim with his dear friend, Alar Deem."
At least he had not made the same foolish mistake with Simon Silvertongue.
"See there, father," he wanted to shout. "See how fast I learn my lessons."
Catelyn. It was full dark before they found the village. Catelyn found herself wondering if the place had a name. If so, its people had taken that knowledge with them when they fled, along with all they owned, down to the candles in the sept. Sir Wendell lit a torch and led her through the low door. Within, the seven walls were cracked and crooked. "God is one," Septon Osmond had taught her when she was a girl, "with seven aspects, as the sept is a single building with seven walls." The wealthiest septs of the cities had statues of the seven and an altar to each. In Winterfell, Septon Shale hung carved masks from each wall. Here, Catelyn found only rough charcoal drawings. Sir Wendell set the torch in a sconce near the door and left to wait outside with Robar Royce. Catelyn studied the faces. The father was bearded, as ever. The mother smiled, loving and protective. The warrior had his sword sketched in beneath his face. The smith, his hammer. The maid was beautiful. The crone, wizened and wise. And the seventh face, the stranger, was neither male nor female, yet both, ever the outcast, the wanderer from fireplaces, less and more than human, unknown and unknowable. Here the face was a black oval, a shadow with stars for eyes. It made Catelyn uneasy. She would get scant comfort there. She knelt before the mother. "My lady, look down on this battle with a mother's eyes. They are all sons, every one. Spare them if you can, and spare my own sons as well. Watch over Rob and Bran and Rickon. Would that I were with them." A crack ran down through the mother's left eye. It made her look as if she were crying. Catelyn could hear Sir Wendell's booming voice, and now and again Sir Robar's quiet answers, as they talked of the coming battle. Otherwise, the night was still. Not even a cricket could be heard, and the guards kept their silence. "Did your old guards ever answer you, Ned?" she wondered. "When you knelt before your heart tree, did they hear you?" Flickering torchlight danced across the walls, making the faces seem half alive, twisting them, changing them. The statues in the great septs of the cities wore the faces the stonemasons had given them, but these charcoal scratchings were so crude they might be anyone. The father's face made her think of her own father dying in his bed at Riverrun. The warrior was Renly and Stannis, Rob and Robert, Jaime Lannister and Jon Snow. She even glimpsed Arya in those lines, just for an instant. Then a gust of wind through the door made the torch sputter, and the semblance was gone, washed away in orange glare. The smoke was making her eyes burn. She rubbed at them with the heels of her scarred hands. When she looked up at the mother again, it was her own mother she saw. Lady Minnesota Tully had died in childbed, trying to give Lord Huster a second son. The baby had perished with her, and afterward some of the life had gone out of father. She was always so calm, Catelyn thought, remembering her mother's soft hands, her warm smile. If she had lived, how different our lives might have been. She wondered what Lady Minnesota would make of her eldest daughter, kneeling here before her. "I have come so many thousands of leagues, and for what? Who have I served? I've lost my daughters. Rob does not want me, and Bran and Rickon must surely think me a cold and unnatural mother. I was not even with Ned when he died." Her head swam, and the sept seemed to move around her. The shadows swayed and shifted, furtive animals racing across the cracked white walls. Catelyn had not eaten today. Perhaps that had been unwise. She told herself that there had been no time. But the truth was that food had lost its savour in a world without Ned. When they took his head off, they killed me too. Behind her, the torch spit, and suddenly it seemed to her that it was her sister's face on the wall. though the eyes were harder than she recalled. Not Lysa's eyes, but Circe's. Circe is a mother, too. No matter who fathered those children, she felt them kick inside her, brought them forth with her pain and blood, nursed them at her breast. If they are truly Jaime's... "Does Circe pray to you too, my lady?" Catelyn asked the mother. She could see the proud, cold, lovely features of the Lannister queen etched upon the wall. The crack was still there. Even Circe could weep for her children.
"Each of the seven embodies all of the seven,"
Septon Osmond had told her once. There was as much beauty in the crone as in the maiden, and the mother could be fiercer than the warrior when her children were in danger.
"Yes."
She had seen enough of Robert Baratheon at Winterfell to know that the king did not regard Joffrey with any great warmth. If the boy was truly Jaime's seed, Robert would have put him to death, along with his mother, and few would have condemned him. Bastards were common enough, but incest was a monstrous sin to both old gods and new, and the children of such wickedness were named abominations in Sept and Godswood alike. The Dragon Kings had wed brother to sister, but they were the blood of old Valyria, where such practices had been common. And like their dragons, the Targaryens answered to neither gods nor men. Ned must have known, and Lord Aeron before him. Small wonder that the queen had killed them both. Would I do any less for my own? Catelyn clenched her hands, feeling the tightness in her scarred fingers where the assassin's steel had cut to the bone as she fought to save her son.
"Bran knows too," she whispered, lowering her head. "Gods be good. He must have seen something, heard something. That was why they had tried to kill him in his bed."
Lost and weary, Catelyn Stark gave herself over to her gods. She knelt before the smith, who fixed things that were broken, and asked that he give her sweet Bran his protection. She went to the maid and beseeched her to lend her courage to Arya and Sansa, to guard them in their innocence. To the father she prayed for justice, the strength to seek it, and the wisdom to know it. And she asked the warrior to keep Robb strong and shield him in his battles. Lastly, she turned to the crone, whose statues often showed her with a lamp in one hand. "Guide me, wise lady," she prayed. "Show me the path I must walk, and do not let me stumble in the dark places that lie ahead." Finally, there were footsteps behind her, and a noise at the door. "My lady," Sir Robar said gently, "pardon, but our time is at an end. We must be back before the dawn breaks." Catelyn rose stiffly. Her knees ached, and she would have given much for a feather bed and a pillow just then. "Thank you, sir. I am ready." They rode in silence through sparse woodland, where the trees leaned drunkenly away from the sea. The nervous whinny of horses and the clank of steel guided them back to Renly's camp. The long ranks of man and horse were armoured in darkness, as black as if the smith had hammered night itself into steel. There were banners to her right, banners to her left, and rank on rank of banners before her. But in the pre-dawn gloom neither colours nor sigils could be discerned. A grey army, Catelyn thought, grey men on grey horses beneath grey banners. As they sat their horses waiting, Renly's shadow knights pointed their lances upward, so she rode through a forest of tall, naked trees bereft of leaves and life. Where Storm's End stood was only a deeper darkness, a wall of black, through which no stars could shine, but she could see torches moving across the fields where Lord Stannis had made his camp. The candles within Renly's pavilion made the shimmering silken wall seem to glow, transforming the great tent into a magical castle alive with emerald light. Two of the Rainbow Guards stood sentry at the door to the royal pavilion. The green light shone strangely against the purple plums of Sir Parman's surcoat, and gave a sickly hue to the sunflowers that covered every inch of Sir Eamon's enamelled yellow plate. Long silken plumes flew from their helms,
and rainbow cloaks draped their shoulders. Within, Catelyn found Brian armouring the king for battle, while the lords Tarly and Rowan spoke of dispositions and tactics. It was pleasantly warm inside, the heat shimmering off the coals of a dozen small braziers. "I must speak with you, Your Grace," she said, granting him a king's style for once, anything to make him heed her. "In a moment, Lady Catelyn," Renly replied. Brian fit backplate to breastplate over his quilted tunic. The king's armour was a deep green, the green of leaves in a summer wood, so dark it drank the candlelight. Gold highlights gleamed from inlay and fastenings like distant fires in that wood, winking every time he moved. "Pray continue, Lord Mathis." "Your Grace," Mathis Rowan said, with a sideways glance at Catelyn, "as I was saying, our battles are well drawn up. Why wait for daybreak? Sound the advance." "And have it said that I won by treachery, with an unchivalrous attack?" "Dawn was the chosen hour."
"Chosen by Stannis," Randall Tarly pointed out. "He'd have us charge into the teeth of the rising sun. We'll be half blind."
"Only until first shock," Renly said confidently. "Sir Loras will break them, and after that it will be chaos." Brian tightened green leather straps and buckled golden buckles. "When my brother falls, see that no insult is done to his corpse. He is my own blood. I will not have his head paraded about on the spear."
"And if he yields?" Lord Tarly asked.
"Yields?" Lord Rowan laughed.
"When Mace Tyrell laid siege to Storm's End, Stannis ate rats rather than open his gates."
"Well, I remember." Renly lifted his chin to allow Brian to fasten his gorget in place. "Near the end, Sir Gawain Wilde and three of his knights tried to steal out of a postern gate to surrender. Stannis caught them and ordered them flung from the walls with catapults. I can still see Gawain's face as they strapped him down. He had been our master at arms." Lord Rowan appeared puzzled.
"No men were hurled from the walls. I surely remember that."
"Maester Cressin told Stannis that we might be forced to eat our dead, and there was no gain in flinging away good meat." Renly pushed back his hair. Brian bound it with a velvet tie and pulled a padded cap down over his ears to cushion the weight of his helm. "Thanks to the Onion Knight, we were never reduced to dining on corpses, but it was a close thing. Too close for Sir Gawain, who died in his cell." "Your Grace," Catelyn had waited patiently, but time grew short. "You promised me a word." Renly nodded. "Siege your battles, my lords. Oh, and if Barristan Selmy is at my brother's side, I want him spared."
"There's been no word of Sir Barristan since Joffrey cast him out,"
Lord Rowan objected. "I know that old man. He needs a king to guard, or who is he? Yet he never came to me, and Lady Catelyn says he is not with Robb Stark at Riverrun. Where else but with Stannis?"
"As you say, your Grace, no harm will come to him."
The lords bowed deeply and departed. "Say your say, Lady Stark," Renly said. Brian swept his cloak over his broad shoulders. It was cloth of gold, heavy, with a crown stag of Baratheon picked out in flakes of jet. "The Lannisters tried to kill my son, Bran. 1,000 times I have asked myself why. Your brother gave me my answer. There was a hunt the day he fell. Robert and Ned and most of the other men rode out after the boar, but Jaime Lannister remained at Winterfell, as did the Queen." Renly was not slow to take the implication. "So, you believe the boy caught them at their incest? I beg you, my lord, grant me leave to go to your brother Stannis and tell him what I suspect."
"To what end?"
"Robb will set aside the crown if you and your brother will do the same," she said, hoping it was true. She would make it true if she must. Robb would listen to her, even if his lords would not. "Let the three of you call for a great council, such as the realm has not seen for 100 years. We will send to Winterfell, so Bran may tell his tale and all men may know the Lannisters for the true usurpers. Let the assembled lords of the 7 kingdoms choose who shall rule them."
Renly laughed. Tell me, my lady, do direwolves vote on who should lead the pack? Brienne brought the king's gauntlets and great helm, crowned with golden antlers, that would add a foot and a half to his height. The time for talk is done. Now we will see who is stronger. Renly pulled a lobstered green and gold gauntlet over his left hand, while Brienne knelt to buckle on his belt, heavy with the weight of a long sword and dagger.
I beg you, in the name of the mother, Catelyn began when a sudden gust of wind flung open the door of the tent. She thought she glimpsed movement, but when she turned her head, it was only the king's shadow shifting against the silken walls. She heard Renly begin a jest, his shadow moving, lifting its sword, black on green, candles guttering, shivering. Something was queer, wrong. And then she saw Renly's sword still in its scabbard, sheathed still, but the shadow sword. Cold, said Renly, in a small, puzzled voice, a heartbeat before the steel of his gorget parted like cheesecloth beneath the shadow of a blade that was not there. He had time to make a small, thick gasp before the blood came gushing out of his throat.
Your great...
No! Cried Brienne the Blue, when she saw that evil flow, sounding as scared as any little girl. The king stumbled into her arms, a sheet of blood creeping down the front of his armour, a dark red tide that drowned his green and gold. More candles guttered out. Renly tried to speak, but he was choking on his own blood. His legs collapsed, and only Brienne's strength held him up. She threw back her head and screamed, wordless in her anguish.
The shadow. Something dark and evil had happened here, she knew. Something that she could not begin to understand.
Renly never cast that shadow. Death came in that door and blew the life out of him, as swift as the wind snuffed out his candles.
Only a few instants passed before Robar Royce and Eamon Kai came bursting in, though it felt like half the night. A pair of men-at-arms crowded in behind with torches. When they saw Renly in Brienne's arms and her drenched with the king's blood, Sir Robar gave a cry of horror.
"Wicked woman!" screamed Sir Eamon, he of the sun-flowered steel. "Away from him, you vile creature!"
"Gods be good, Brienne, why?" asked Sir Robar.
Brienne looked up from her king's body. The rainbow cloak that hung from her shoulders had turned red where the king's blood had soaked into the cloth.
I...
You'll die for this! Sir Eamon snatched up a long-handled battle-axe from the weapons pile near the door. You'll pay for the king's life with your own!
No! Catelyn Stark screamed, finding her voice at last. But it was too late. The blood madness was on them, and they rushed forward with shouts that drowned her softer words.
Brienne moved faster than Catelyn would have believed. Her own sword was not to hand, so she snatched Renly's from his scabbard and raised it to catch Eamon's axe on the downswing. A spark flashed blue-white as steel met steel with a rending crash, and Brienne sprang to her feet, the body of the dead king thrust rudely aside. Sir Eamon stumbled over it as he tried to close, and Brienne's blade sheared through the wooden haft to send his axe-head spinning. Another man thrust a flaming torch at her back, but the rainbow cloak was too sudden with blood to burn. Brienne spun and cut, and torch and hand went flying. Flames crept across the carpet. The maimed man began to scream. Sir Eamon dropped the axe and fumbled for his sword. The second man at arms lunged. Brienne parried, and their swords danced and clanged against each other. When Eamon Kai came wading back in, Brienne was forced to retreat, yet somehow she held them both at bay. On the ground, Renly's head rolled sickeningly to one side, and a second mouth yawned wide, the blood coming from him now in slow pulses. Sir Robar had hung back, uncertain, but now he was reaching for his hilt. "Robar, no, listen!" Catelyn seized his arm. "You do her wrong. It was not her. Help her!"
"Hear me, it was Stannis!"
The name was on her lips before she could think how it got there. But as she said it, she knew that it was true.
"I swear it, you know me, it was Stannis killed him!"
The young Rainbow Knight stared at this mad woman with pale and frightened eyes.
"Stannis? How?"
"I do not know. Sorcery, some dark magic. There was a shadow, a shadow." Her own voice sounded wild and crazed to her, but the words poured out in a rush as the blades continued to clash behind her.
"A shadow with a sword, I swear it. I saw. Are you blind? The girl loved him. Help her."
She glanced back, saw the second guardsman fall, his blade dropping from limp fingers. Outside, they were shouting. More angry men would be bursting in on them any instant, she knew.
"She is innocent, Robar. You have my word, on my husband's grave, and my honour as a Stark."
That resolved him.
"I will hold them," Sir Robar said. "Get her away."
He turned and went out. The fire had reached the wall and was creeping up the side of the tent. Sir Eamon was pressing Brian hard, him in his enamelled yellow steel and her in wool. He had forgotten Catelyn until the iron brazier came crashing into the back of his head. Helmed as he was, the blow did no lasting harm, but it sent him to his knees.
"Brian, with me!"
Catelyn commanded. The girl was not slow to see the chance. A slash, and the green silk parted. They stepped out into darkness and the chill of dawn. Loud voices came from the other side of the pavilion.
"This way," Catelyn urged. "And slowly. We must not run, or they will ask why. Walk easy, as if nothing were amiss."
Brienne thrust her sword blade through her belt and fell in beside Catelyn. The night air smelled of rain. Behind them the king's pavilion was well ablaze, flames rising high against the dark. No one made any move to stop them. Men rushed past them, shouting of fire and murder and sorcery. Others stood in small groups and spoke in low voices. A few were praying, and one young squire was on his knees, sobbing openly. Renly's battles were already coming apart, as the rumours spread from mouth to mouth. The night fires had burned low, and as the east began to lighten, the immense mass of Storm's End emerged like a dream of stone, while wisps of pale mist raced across the field, flying from the sun on wings of wind. Morning ghosts, she'd heard old Nan call them once, spirits returning to their graves. And Renly, one of them now, gone like his brother Robert, like her own dear Ned.
"I never held him but as he died," Brian said quietly as they walked through the spreading chaos.
Her voice sounded as if she might break at any instant.
"He was laughing one moment, and suddenly the blood was everywhere. My lady, I do not understand. Did you see? Did you?"
"I saw a shadow. I thought it was Renly's shadow at first, but it was his brother's.
Lord Stannis? I felt him. It makes no sense, I know."
It made sense enough for Brienne.
"I will kill him,"
the tall, homely girl declared.
"With my lord's own sword, I will kill him. I swear it. I swear it! I swear it!"
Hal Mullen and the rest of her escort were waiting with the horses. Sir Wendell Manderley was all of a lather to know what was happening.
"My lady, the camp has gone mad," he blurted when he saw them. "Lord Renly is here."
He stopped suddenly, staring at Brienne and the blood that drenched her. "Dead, but not by our hands."
"The battle,"
Hal Mullen began. There will be no battle. Catelyn mounted, and her escort formed up about her, with Sir Wendell to her left and Sir Perrin Frey on her right. "Brian, we brought Mansonoff for twice our number. Choose one and come with us."
"I have my own horse, my lady, and my armor."
"Leave them. We must be well away before they think to look for us. We were both with the king when he was killed. That will not be forgotten." Wordless, Brian turned and did as she was bid. "Ride," Catelyn commanded her escort when they were all a horse. "If any man tries to stop us, cut him down." As the long fingers of dawn fanned across the fields, colour was returning to the world. Where grey men had sat grey horses armed with shadow spears, the points of 10,000 lances now glinted silverly cold, and on the myriad flapping banners Catelyn saw the blush of red and pink and orange, the richness of blues and browns, the blaze of gold and yellow. All the power of Storm's End and High Garden, the power that had been Renly's an hour ago. They belong to Stannis now, she realized, even if they do not know it themselves yet. Where else are they to turn, if not to the last Baratheon? Stannis has won all with a single evil stroke. I am the rightful king, he had declared, his jaw clenched hard as iron, and your son, no less a traitor than my brother here. His day will come as well. A chill went through her. Eddard. Robert, I beg of you, Ned pleaded. Hear what you're saying. You're talking of murdering a child.
The whore is pregnant.
The king's fist slammed down on the council table, loud as a thunderclap. I warned you this would happen, Ned. Back in the Barrowlands, I warned you. But you did not care to hear it. Well, you'll hear it now. I want them dead, mother and child, both. And that fool Viserys as well. Is that plain enough for you? I want them dead. The other councillors were all doing their best to pretend that they were somewhere else. No doubt they were wiser than he was. Eddard Stark had seldom felt quite so alone. You will dishonour yourself forever if you do this. Then let it be on my head, as long as it's done. I'm not so blind that I cannot see the shadow of the axe when it is hanging over my own neck. There is no axe, Ned told the king. Only the shadow of a shadow, 20 years removed, if it exists at all. If, Varys asked softly, bringing powdered hands together. My lord, you wrong me. Would I bring lies to king and council? Ned looked at the eunuch coldly. You would bring us the whisperings of a traitor half a world away, my lord. Perhaps Mormont is wrong. Perhaps he is lying. Sir Jorah would not dare deceive me, Varys said with a sly smile. Rely on it, my lord. The princess is with child. So you say. If you are wrong, we need not fear. If the girl miscarries, we need not fear. If she births a daughter in place of a son, we need not fear. If the babe dies in infancy, we need not fear. But if it is a boy, Robert insisted, if he lives, the narrow sea would still lie between us. I shall fear the Dothraki the day they teach the horses to run on water. The king took a swallow of wine and glowered at Ned across the council table. So you would counsel me to do nothing until the dragonspawn has landed his army on my shores, is that it? This dragonspawn is in his mother's belly, Ned said. Even Aegon did no conquering until after he was weaned.
Gods, you are stubborn as an oryx, Stark.
The king looked round the council table.
Have the rest of you mislaid your tongues? Will no one talk sense to this frozen-faced fool?
Varys gave the king an unctuous smile and laid a soft hand on Ned's sleeve. I understand your qualms, Lord Eddard, truly I do. It gave me no joy to bring this grievous news to council. It is a terrible thing we contemplate, a vile thing. Yet we who presume to rule must do vile things for the good of the realm, however much it pains us. Lord Renly shrugged. The matter seems simple enough to me. We ought to have had Viserys and his sister killed years ago, but his grace, my brother, made the mistake of listening to John Aaron. Mercy is never a mistake, Lord Renly, Ned replied. On the Trident, Sir Barristan here cut down 12 good men, Robert's friends and mine. When they brought him to us, grievously wounded and near death, Roose Bolton urged us to cut his throat, but your brother said,
I will not kill a man for loyalty, nor for fighting well. And he sent his own maester to tend Sir Barristan's wounds. He gave the king a long, cool look. Would that man were here today. Robert had shame enough to blush.
It was not the same, he complained. Sir Barristan was a knight of the king's guard,
whereas Daenerys is a 14-year-old girl. Ned knew he was pushing this well past the point of wisdom, yet he could not keep silent. Robert, I ask you, what did we rise against Aerys Targaryen for, if not to put an end to the murder of children?
To put an end to Targaryens, the king growled.
Your Grace, I never knew you to fear Rhaegar. Ned fought to keep his scorn out of his voice and failed.
Have the years so unmanned you that you tremble at the shadow of an unborn child?
Robert purpled.
No more, Ned,
he warned, pointing.
Not another word. Have you forgotten who is king here?
No, Your Grace, Ned replied.
Have you?
Enough, the king bellowed.
I'm sick of talk. I'll be done with this, or be damned. What say you all?
She must be killed, Lord Renly declared.
We have no choice, murmured Varys, sadly, sadly.
Sir Barristan Selmy raised his pale blue eyes from the table and said, Your Grace, there is honour in facing an enemy on the battlefield, but none in killing him in his mother's womb. Forgive me, but I must stand with Lord Eddard. Grand Maester Pycelle cleared his throat, a process that seemed to take some minutes.
My order serves the realm, not the ruler. Once I counselled King Aerys as loyally as I counsel King Robert now, so I bear this girl-child of his no ill will. Yet I ask you this. Should war come again, how many soldiers will die? How many towns will be burnt? How many children will be ripped from their mothers to perish on the end of a spear?
He stroked his luxuriant white beard, infinitely sad, infinitely weary.
Is it not wiser, even kinder, that Daenerys Targaryen should die now, so that tens of thousands might live?
Kinder, Varys said.
Oh, well and truly spoken, Grandmaster, it is so true. Should the gods in their caprice grant Daenerys Targaryen a son, the realm must bleed.
Littlefinger was the last. As Ned looked at him, Lord Petar stifled a yawn.
When you find yourself in bed with an ugly woman, the best thing to do is close your eyes and get on with it, he declared. Waiting won't make the maid any prettier. Kiss her and be done with it.
Kiss her? Sir Barristan repeated, aghast.
A steel kiss, said Littlefinger.
Robert turned to face his hand.
Well, there it is, Ned. You and Selmy stand alone on this matter. The only question that remains is, who can we find to kill her?
Mormont craves a royal pardon, Lord Renly reminded them.
Desperately, Varys said. Yet he craves life even more. By now the princess nears Vaes Dothrak, where it is death to draw a blade. If I told you what the Dothraki would do to the poor man who used one on a Khaleesi, none of you would sleep tonight.
He stroked a powdered cheek.
Now, poison, the tears of lice, let us say. Khal Drogo need never know. It was not a natural death.
Grand Maester Pycelle's sleepy eyes flicked open. He squinted suspiciously at the eunuch.
Poison is a coward's weapon, the king complained.
Ned had heard enough. You send hard knives to kill a 14-year-old girl, and you still quibble about honour? He pushed back his chair and stood.
Do it yourself, Robert. The man who passes the sentence should swing the sword.
Look her in the eyes before you kill her. See her tears. Hear her last words. You owe her that much, at least.
Gods, the king swore, the word exploding out of him, as if he could barely contain his fury. You mean it, damn you!
He reached for the flagon of wine at his elbow, found it empty, and flung it away to shatter against the wall.
I am out of wine and out of patience. Enough of this. Just have it done.
I will not be part of murder, Robert. Do as you will, but do not ask me to fix my seal to it. For a moment, Robert did not seem to understand what Ned was saying. Defiance was not a dish he tasted often. Slowly his face changed as comprehension came. His eyes narrowed, and a flush crept up his neck past his velvet collar. He pointed an angry finger at Ned.
You are the king's hand, Lord Stark. You will do as I command you, or I'll find me a hand who will.
I wish him every success. Ned unfastened the heavy clasp that clutched at the folds of his cloak, the ornate silver hand that was his badge of office. He laid it on the table in front of the king, saddened by the memory of the man who had pinned it on him, the friend he had loved. I thought you were a better man than this, Robert. I thought we had made a nobler king. Robert's face was purple.
Out! He croaked, choking on his rage. Out! Damn you! I've done with you! What are you waiting for? Go run back to Winterfell and make certain I never look on your face again, or I swear I'll have your head on a spike.
Ned bowed and turned on his heel without another word. He could feel Robert's eyes on his back. As he strode from the council chambers, the discussion resumed with scarcely a pause. On Braavos there is a society called the Faceless Men, Grand Maester Pycelle offered. Do you have any idea how costly they are? Littlefinger complained. You could hire an army of common sellswords for half the price, and that's for a merchant. I don't dare think what they might ask for a princess. The closing of the door behind him silenced their voices. Sir Boris Blunt was stationed outside the chamber, wearing the long white cloak and armour of the King's Guard. He gave Ned a quick, curious glance from the corner of his eye, but asked no questions. The day felt heavy and oppressive as he crossed the bailey back to the Tower of the Hand. He could feel the threat of rain in the air. Ned would have welcomed it. It might have made him feel a trifle less unclean. When he reached his solar, he summoned Vaen Poole. The steward came at once. "You sent for me, my Lord Hand?" "Hand no longer," Ned told him. "The king and I have quarrelled. We shall be returning to Winterfell." "I shall begin making arrangements at once, my lord. We will need a fortnight to ready everything for the journey." "We may not have a fortnight. We may not have a day. The king mentioned something about seeing my head on a spike." Ned frowned. He did not truly believe the king would harm him. Not Robert. He was angry now, but once Ned was safely out of sight, his rage would cool as it always did. Always? Suddenly uncomfortable, he found himself recalling Rhaegar Targaryen. 15 years dead, yet Robert hates him as much as ever. It was a disturbing notion. And there was the other matter, the business with Catelyn and the dwarf, that Yoren had warned him of last night. That would come to light soon. As sure as sunrise, and with the king in such a black fury. Robert might not care a fig for Tyrion Lannister, but it would touch on his pride, and there was no telling what the queen might do. "It might be safest if I went on ahead," he told Poole. "I will take my daughters and a few guardsmen. The rest of you can follow when you're ready. Inform Jory, but tell no one else, and do nothing until the girls and I have gone. The castle is full of eyes and ears, and I would rather my plans were not known." "As you command, my lord." When he had gone, Eddard Stark went to the window and sat brooding. Robert had left him no choice that he could see. He ought to thank him. It would be good to return to Winterfell. He ought never to have left. His sons were waiting there. Perhaps he and